Welcome. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you are listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. The effects of childhood trauma can be visible, but most of the time, trauma leaves an invisible mark that is disguised as bad behavior, learning disabilities, aggression, and so much more. More often than not, children will not get the treatment they need to heal, but instead receive labels based on their symptoms that they may be exhibiting. In today's episode, I speak with child psychologist Dr. Samantha Sweeney, and later in the show, we speak with Melanie Holland of Hortons Kids to tell us how they are helping kids in at-risk communities thrive. Well, joining me now is child psychologist Dr. Samantha Sweeney. Dr. Sweeney, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first off, could you explain what is childhood trauma?
Sure. So simply put, like as simple as possible, even though this is a really complicated topic, childhood trauma is adverse childhood experiences, or what we think of as ACE, A-C-E. And there are several different types of experiences that a child can have under three different categories of abuse, neglect, and then household dysfunction. These range from things like physical, sexual, emotional abuse to violence in the home, having an incarcerated parent, divorce, death of a parent. These are all types of traumatic experiences that children can have. I think the ACE scores are really indicative of the individualized piece of trauma. And then there's also more community aspects of trauma. If there's community violence, if there's economic stress in the community, if the community itself is neglected, which, you know, different parts of different cities and different communities are neglected. And then, you know, things like racism, sexism affect children as well.
What is the impact trauma can have on a child?
Such a good question, and it's so complicated to answer because there are so many different types of outcomes that a child can have. But to be as brief as possible, so children can have all sorts of outcomes, and not just children. Like, this can extend, you know, well into adulthood. You know, can last a person's whole life. There can be lots of emotional outcomes, right? So children can struggle with anxiety, depression, they can have sleep disturbances, they can have, you know, struggle with different stressors more than their friends can. There can be, you know, behavioral outcomes. What we see often is something like ADHD, where a child seems to be inattentive or really hyperactive, could be a result of trauma. I think it's really important to point out too that it's not just emotional and behavioral outcomes that children can have, but also health outcomes. So the impact of trauma can be, you know, again, we're thinking more in adulthood here, but can be heart disease. There are studies that show that autoimmune disease, like people are more susceptible to autoimmune disease because they have experienced a certain amount of trauma. So the effects can be numerous on children and then last well into adulthood.
Yes, I've also experienced childhood trauma. And to be honest, I didn't even realize that what I was dealing with and all my different behaviors with ADHD and learning abilities, I didn't realize that it was trauma literally until 20 years later. Sure. And so I think this is extremely important. And, you know, even 10 years ago, they diagnosed me bipolar because they just kind of assumed that, oh, well, you know, similar symptoms. And I guess at that time, 10 years ago, they didn't really relate the symptoms of trauma and just someone who was sexually abused. So I know that it can be difficult to diagnose, but I can only assume that it's more difficult to diagnose trauma in a child.
Yeah, I mean, the diagnosis piece is a really interesting question because in a lot of ways, we're not diagnosing trauma itself a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. We're diagnosing the behavioral outcomes of trauma, right? So in the DSM-5, which is the Diagnosis and Statistical Manual, which is basically like the therapist Bible, it's how we assign diagnoses to different individuals. And there are a set of trauma and stress-related disorders. Those can be diagnosed in children, things like PTS, post-traumatic stress disorder is an example of that. But often what we see in children is the symptoms might look a lot like depression. They might look a lot like anxiety. They might look a lot like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It might look like a lot of these things. And I think what's really important as a therapist, as a psychologist, is to really dig deep into what some of the causes of these things might be. That's not to say that we don't treat the behavior that we see, can't ignore the behavior. That's not helpful to the child either. But ignoring the underlying cause of it is also not helpful. Continuing to dig when you are working with children who you may suspect have experienced some sort of trauma, or any children, is really important to continue to dig if you feel like there's something there.
So as a therapist, how do you dig, especially when you're dealing with a young child?
It's not easy, but I think, you know, continually asking questions. I think it's a bit of a balance, and it's hard for me to explain exactly how it happens, because I think a lot of it has to do with the child's temperament. A lot of it has to do with the child's personality. I think there is a very thin line for therapists between, you know, continually being curious about a child and leading a child. I do a lot of artwork with my clients. So I like to give clients a lot of different opportunities to express themselves. So riding that fine line and giving kids opportunity for self-expression, I think, is a big piece of this work.
You did talk about like economic stress and community violence, and in these at-risk communities, what are some of the ways to alleviate or reduce the stress and the trauma for a child?
Absolutely. This is such a good question. And I'm so glad you're asking this, because there are just so many ways that you can alleviate some of that. I think sometimes you look at situations like that and we're like, it's hopeless. There's nothing we can do. And that's not true at all. The biggest thing, one of the biggest protective factors in a child's life, is having an adult that they trust, an adult that is clearly someone that cares about them and that child has trust in. And so having an adult in a child's life that they really trust can have an enormous and significantly lasting impact. Another thing has to do with creating consistency and predictability in a child's life. This is so incredibly important. The stress of something like community violence, of economic stress, or as parents who lose jobs, or like, you know, there's not a lot of consistency in a child's life. You know, there's constant stress reaction from a child, because they're constantly asking questions. Well, is mommy going to be here today, or is she have to leave? Or is when I walk home from school today, is it going to be unsafe? Or, you know, if I walk this way, is this a safer way to walk home? Or so there's constantly questions going through a child's mind living in circumstances such as that. And so having as much consistency and predictability in a child's life where they know what to expect makes an enormous difference. And having loving and nurturing relationships. There are lots of children who have been through circumstances where they've lived in economic strife or in places where there's violence, but because they've had really wonderful parents at home who are really supportive of them, who love them, who nurture them, who take care of them, or they have schools that are really loving and nurturing, those kids thrive and really get to not just meet their potential, but exceed it. And I think that's really important. And then one other additional thing I'll say is, through having like these nurturing relationships and this adult that they trust, having high expectations of a child. And I'm not saying high expectations where, you know, you're setting these impossible standards where it's impossible for them to reach it, but really asking them to expect more from themselves. Like, you are more than your circumstances. You can achieve more than you think you can. You can achieve more than you're seeing, is incredibly powerful for children. And that's something, there's actually a term for that called the Pygmalion effect, that whatever you expect of a child is what they'll give you. So if you expect a child to be disruptive, if you expect them to not read well, if you expect them to not do well in school, they're not going to. If you expect a child to do well, if you have high expectations of them, they're going to reach it. And so having those high expectations is an incredible protective factor as well.
Amazing. I really love that you said that, because I mean, as a parent, that's a lot for me to take in. But yes, I feel like that's amazing. And especially the idea of having an adult in your life. I know I volunteered with Horton's Kids and Literacy Lab, and especially Horton's Kids, you know, both those organizations are in DC. Horton's Kids, they see these kids, they tutor these kids, and you know, 100% of Horton's Kids graduated from high school. And, you know, and these are kids who are from the most at-risk communities in DC. And just, you know, the idea of having that adult is so important. And you can see it with these organizations who are working with these children. And I know that for me, you know, the long-term effects of trauma, untreated trauma, were really hard on my life. The idea of not being worthy and, you know, ADHD, all of that. What are the long-term effects of untreated trauma?
I think it's what I mentioned before, just exacerbated, right? So these emotional issues that we see, you know, when a child is experiencing something like anxiety, depression at a very young age, is feeling suicidal, is struggling with school, is just feeling badly about themselves all the time. If that lasts through high school, through college, through, you know, if they go to college, if they, through whatever life experiences they have, can have really detrimental effects on them, you know, long term. And I think that, you know, like you were saying, you can have suicidal thoughts, you can have relationship issues. You'll see a lot of people who have been through trauma have relationships that are really unhealthy. They sometimes have difficulty holding jobs. You know, I don't want to talk about these things as if they're definitely going to happen, right? As if it's like automatically, if you experience trauma, then like these are going to be your negative effects. But there are a number of different options in terms of what could potentially happen. What we're talking about here is the long-term effect of stress. What trauma does for a child is it makes them hypervigilant. Basically, it raises their stress response. And when you have a stress response, you emit these different chemicals in your body known as adrenaline and cortisol. There are really positive types of stress, like getting ready for a test or preparing yourself for a big game or like meeting a new person. Like that can, all those things can be stressful and you have stress responses to those things. But when you go through something like trauma and you have to always have to be kind of aware of things that could happen to you, then you're emitting these stress hormones all of the time. And what we do know, I'm not a medical doctor, so I'm not going to get into the weeds with this because that's not my area of expertise, but the effects that stress have on the body and on the brain and on the spirit and the mind long term, when you are constantly stressed, we know for a fact that those affect you not just emotionally, but they actually affect you physically. They actually affect your genes. And trauma can be passed down generation to generation. So it doesn't just have, when we talk about long-term effects of trauma, we're talking about the long-term effects of stress, talking about emotional effects, we're talking about behavioral effects, but we're also talking about genetic effects.
I actually spoke with a psychologist about transgenerational trauma. It was my first episode and I was kind of blown away by what I learned. And I think that's the thing that I feel like you said, long-term effects of untreated trauma, it just perpetuates it from generation to generation. And I think more than anything that should really, I guess, encourage people if they know that they've dealt with some trauma to seek help. I think that is definitely something people should be doing. If they can get the help, get the help. I do know that, again, you know, in at-risk communities where the trauma is high, you know, they may not have the access to psychiatrists, psychologists. What advice do you have for them?
This is such a difficult question. I would say that there are community resources available. They do exist. There are not enough of them. And I think we as a society, not just the people who are experiencing community violence and economic stress, like high trauma areas and stuff, but the rest of us have a responsibility to advocate for more community mental health services, more community mental health opportunities, you know, for people, like for places for people to go. I think advocacy plays an enormous role in this, not just for the people who are experiencing it, but all of us. I would say that schools are a really good place to start, but I hesitate a little bit on that. Having worked in schools before, I started my career as a school psychologist, and it's my training. Schools are really overtaxed. And I think advocacy comes in here too, because school is a really good place to start, but schools aren't really equipped to treat trauma. And so it's tricky. It really is.
More people need to advocate for these community organizations. And I I'm 100% behind that. And, you know, you did mention, you know, teachers, counselors, coaches, they're not there to treat, they're there to teach.
Right.
But what are some things, you know, as well, I guess kids are not really going back to school right now. What should teachers, once they do, what should teachers, counselors, coaches, what should they be looking for to identify someone who may be, and not just label them like, oh, they're just bad behaviors, but should they be addressing it, you said digging, or is that too far outside of their job role?
I think it's the responsibility of teachers, coaches, counselors, right? We're mandated reporters, right? So if we see something that we suspect, we report it. That's required by law. And it's not our job to wonder or to ask questions or to any, but if we suspect any kind of abuse or neglect, to report it. And so I don't know that teachers should be digging per se. I think that there is a really fine line there where, like, you go too far and it's you're questioning your ethics there, which is not positive. But I think when you notice something, to speak up. And for different, there are different things to look for different ages. I think with the number one thing I can suggest is when a teacher gets to know a child, or a counselor knows a child, or a coach knows a child, notice when a child's behavior changes. So when you see a shift, a noticeable shift in a child's behavior, alarm bells should go off. Did that necessarily mean that a child has been through, like, a traumatic experience? No. But there, you'd want to put it on your radar somewhere. And every school has clinicians. They have counselors, psychologists, social workers. If you're not comfortable with digging, like if a teacher's not comfortable digging or a coach isn't comfortable digging, they can talk to one of those people and just say, like, would you mind following up with the student? I know that because that used to be my job. But for little kids, I think we're looking at, like, them being very fearful. Like, we're seeing excessive fears. We're seeing, like, excessive crying. And again, this is all relative. Like, I knew when my kids first went off to school at 3, like, there was a kid who cried almost every day. Like, he cried. And I don't think that he was being, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I think he was just having trouble separating. And that was just his way of dealing. And he was crying every day. But that's different from a child who is being happily going to school every single day and then all of a sudden, like, just starts, like, sobbing every day. So again, it's like a shift in behavior, but also, like, how well do you know this child? How different is it from their typical behavior?
That's great advice. Thank you. I do, you know, like I mentioned, I've done work with Horton's Kids and Literacy Lab, and they have been just increasingly trauma-informed. Do you feel that educators should be at least just trauma-informed, or are they?
The answer to your first question is yes. I think they should be trauma-informed, just so that they have that on their radar. You know, there are things where it's more obvious, right? A child comes in and there's a big bruise on their arm. Like, that's obviously going to raise alarm bells. When, you know, a sweet little girl comes in and she, you know, no longer wants to play with her friends and, like, is really being, like, you know, kind of going off to herself, and, like, this lasts for, like, a week. And this is a child who usually likes to play with other kids. That might not raise alarm bells for a lot of teachers, but that might be something that is concerning. So I do 100% think that teachers should be trauma informed. They should at least be aware of what potential things to look for so that they're not guessing. I don't believe that all teachers get that training.
Thank you so much for joining me. I really loved having you on.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you so much for your podcast. I want to say really quickly that I'm so appreciative of the name of your podcast, because I think so often when people struggle with something or they go through something traumatic, the focus is on survival and not thriving. And so I love that you have the Survivor Thrivers podcast, because I think that piece of thriving is so important. So thank you so much for doing this
work. Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that, because I know that it can be a mouthful when you say a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast, but I also do believe that the thriving piece was really important for me, because I was like, oh, I'm okay with just surviving. But then when I started to thrive, that was when things started to change, and that was really important to me.
Mm-hmm. No one should just survive. They should thrive. Everybody should.
That was child psychologist Dr. Samantha Sweeney. If you want to learn more about her, please visit atstpodcast.com. That's the letter A, atstpodcast.com. There you'll find more information about her, her social media handles. And coming up, we will speak to Melanie Holland with Horton's Kids and how they are addressing childhood trauma. Joining me now is Melanie Holland Orr, Elementary Youth Development Senior Manager with Horton's Kids. Thank you so much for joining me, Melanie.
Hey, it's so great to be here. I really appreciate the chance to talk about the work that Horton's Kids is doing.
Absolutely. Why don't you go ahead and tell me about Horton's Kids?
Okay, so Horton's Kids is a nonprofit organization that has been operating in Anacostia, D.C. for over 30 years now. So we're a neighborhood-based organization, so that means we run all our programming out of a community center that's right in the heart of the neighborhood that we serve. So when kids are kind of coming home from school, they usually come right to us instead of kind of going home first. And we really believe that circumstances should not dictate a child's future and that every child should be able to graduate from high school, ready to succeed in college, career, and life. So based on that, we kind of provide a model of holistic and research-based programming that focuses on academics, youth development, family engagement, and those basic needs supports, all of which are designed to kind of empower the children that we serve to succeed.
And you talked about Anacostia in DC. Do you guys consider that an at-risk neighborhood?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So we're located in Ward 8, and we are at risk in the sense of being a food desert. So the closest grocery store is about a mile and a half, 2 mile walk, or you have to take a bus. It's the community in the neighborhood that we serve. It has one of the highest rates of violence in all of DC. And the local high school that the children we serve go to has a graduation rate usually for high school of about 48 to 52% each year.
I feel like I saw somewhere in one of your newsletters that Horton's Kids, actually kids that you serve, there was one year where there was 100% graduation rate. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. We're actually up to 3 years in a row. So that's kind of our running record here that we're very proud of. So for the last 3 years, all of the 12th graders that are still in our programs have graduated high school on time.
You know, when we talk about at-risk neighborhoods, you know, like you said, these are neighborhoods that experience a lot of violence, food desert, economic strain, which actually contribute to developmental trauma in children. And I know that Horton's Kids, they're doing a lot to address trauma in children that you guys serve.
Absolutely. Yeah, you really, you know, kind of nailed it. We truly tried to address trauma in a two-pronged approach. So the first is that we're striving to decrease those traumatic experiences that a child could have, which just like you say, things like food insecurity or financial insecurity. And we do that through those basic needs and family engagement supports. So we have all of our Horton's Kids families have access to free diapers, school supplies, weekend meals. We have a food pantry. If you can think of it, we give it away for free. And we also do a lot of coaching and support for the adults in the community to help them find and keep jobs and really to care for their own emotional wellness as well.
When did you start focusing on trauma? Is that just recently?
I like to think that it's always really been at the core of our mission. So for the first 10 years of Horton's Kids, it was all volunteer led and it was very, I think, problem solving oriented. So we noticed kids were hungry. We found a way to provide food every day. We noticed kids weren't always going to school. We made sure kids were kind of getting up there and going up to school. And so that kind of inner idea of trauma-informed care, I think, has really been tied in to Horton's Kids. But it's really been in the last few years that we have tried to push ourselves to make sure that we are building that in and being more formalized in the way that we have trauma-informed care practices. And so that looks like, you know, we coach our staff and volunteers to make sure that they are being trauma-informed in their interactions with the community as well.
So what benefits have you witnessed among Horton's Kids?
For me, the biggest benefits I see are in the relationships that staffs and volunteers are able to make with our participants. So simply, you know, just like regular adult-to-adult relationships as well, really knowing where a person is coming from, what their experiences have been, what their maybe physiological or emotional responses might be, and really knowing how to respond in a way that will make them feel loved and safe and supported. It really creates a basis for stronger and deeper relationships. So over my 3 years, it's just been really fun to see how those relationships have flourished and just grown so much. And I think that Horton's Kids has really set up an environment that is not punitive. And I think kids feel really comfortable in that environment. So unlike some of their schools, you know, there's not demerits or detention There's no suspensions if they just make a simple mistake. So we really focus on kids choosing actions that meet our expectations. And when they don't, we sit down, have a chat, figure out what's going on, and just make sure they know how to meet expectations next time. Sometimes they view that as a punishment. Sitting down with me for a long time, it sometimes sits over them a little bit. But really the end goal of those conversation is, do you understand what happened? Do you know how to make a better choice? I do think that gives kids the space to feel a little bit more open and kind of accepted as they are.
Yeah, because I know that, you know, children who do experience trauma have behavioral issues, right? And instead of, you know, I've always thought trying to address the cause and, you know, not the symptoms. I feel like that's also extremely important because, you know, in these behavioral issues that they deal with, it kind of takes away from their ability to learn as well.
Oh, absolutely. So I think a simple example, like you say, is if a kid comes to school and maybe they're hungry or they watched, you know, mom and dad argue right before they got to school, they're holding on to those feelings or they're, again, just simply hungry and are struggling to focus. And so I find that teachers who are overwhelmed or underprepared will respond to the anger as if it's sort of like a disciplinary issue or a personal threat, like a child's not caring for them or not respecting them. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like you say, there's something a lot deeper going on. So there's maybe an argument that the kid just hasn't had a chance to process, or hunger that the school wasn't able to address because the student maybe was late. And so there are just a lot of threads to follow. And I think that's the benefit too of after school organizations like Horton's Kids and even others, is that you have that time. You know, at Horton's Kids, if we see that a child seems, you know, unsettled, we call parents, we walk to houses, we knock on doors, we hang out, we kind of get that bigger picture of this child's life and the child's daily experience. And that really helps us to help them at after school and even advocate for them at school.
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
I think the only thing that I always think about is just how, and I like to say it every time I speak with folks, is just how resilient the community that we serve is. I mean, really, if you ask any staff members or any volunteers from Horton's Kids to say, you know, what's it like? What's everybody like over there? You know, resiliency will come up so quickly. I appreciate, you know, I love this work that you're doing, because I think not just with kids and not just with adults, but really just across the board, if we're as a people just more conscious of traumas and experiences, and especially with this community, the resilient mindset that people have, that you get to build those better connections with the community.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Thank you. Again, thank you so much for your time and joining me today.
Yeah, of course. I really appreciate it.
That was Melanie Holland-Orr, Elementary Youth Development Senior Manager with Horton's Kids. For more information about Melanie and Horton's Kids, as well as our previous guest, Dr. Sweeney, please visit atstpodcast.com. That's the letter A, tstpodcast.com. Thank you so much for being a part of the conversation. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you've been listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrive Drivers Podcast. Take care.